Pride Portraits, you know, we're headquartered here in Houston for a reason. It's because we started here. Houston is one of the most diverse cities in the country. And we have so many amazing local heroes. Even people not doing big things are often overlooked. And there's just so much to be celebrated right here at home.
What's up, Houston? Welcome to H-Town Progressive, Houston's impenetrable fortress of progressive thought. I'm your host, Rob Ichsazen. It's now June 2019, Pride Month, and this is our first show in a series of shows we're dedicating to LGBTQIA+ issues in conjunction with Pride Month. We've changed our logo for the month to proudly brandish the rainbow colors in support of Pride, and I, for one, am really looking forward to the Pride Parade and all the other Pride events going on around town this month. It's going to be great. A lot of fun. But amid the fun and celebration, it's important that we not forget, like many of our holidays and celebrations, Pride was born of an epic struggle, a crisis, an existential question of civil rights. The first Pride, as you may know, was a riot that resulted from the institutional oppression of the LGBTQIA+ community and was sparked by a police raid on the Stonewall Inn in Greenwich Village, New York, in 1969. The Pride movement is said to have begun then. What started with the Stonewall riots has evolved into an organized struggle for dignity, respect, and integrity for our LGBTQIA+ siblings. And it is incumbent upon all of us to bear the burden of that struggle. Because as Dr. King famously said, no one is free until we all are free. And much progress has been made, but from the brutal murder of Paul Broussard right here in Montrose in 1991 to the more recent devastating attack on the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida that took the lives of 49 people, members of the LGBTQIA+ community have been and continue to be under attack, particularly under the current hostile administration in Washington. At the time of this recording, 7 of our trans siblings have been murdered this year alone. And so the work of Pride must continue. The struggle must persist. Quite literally, lives depend on it. And so you might be wondering, whether or not you identify as LGBTQIA+, other than outwardly displaying rainbow colors and having a great time during Pride Month, what can I do about it? Well, advocacy is a recurring topic on this program, and all of our episodes this month will include various calls to action. But today's focus covers an aspect of advocacy that we haven't yet addressed on this show, and that's advocacy through art. There's just something about art in its many different manifestations that can do things not otherwise doable. It's hard to explain. You just kind of have to experience it. That's one of the wonderful things about art. It's very personal. It's very human. And today our guest is going to share the very human story of his own personal struggle that led him to create the treasure that is Pride Portraits. It's my honor to welcome to the show today the founder and sole photographer of Pride Portraits, Eric Edward Schell. Eric, welcome to H-Town Progressive.
Thank you.
It's awesome to have you on the show. I'm really excited about the subject today, which is advocacy through art. We're hoping to do several shows where we talk to artists such as yourself about how they do advocacy through art. But of course, today we're talking about Pride Portraits. But before we get into Pride Portraits, I'd like to... for you to share as much as you can the how you evolved into the person that was able to make Pride Portraits.
Let's see. So I've always been an artist from when I was very little. I did musical theater professionally for about 16 years in New York City, San Francisco, and here in Houston. I was with a resident company at the Hobby Center for 6 years here. But I think to go back to things that shaped me to be the person I am today, I think we'd have to go back to preschool. Okay. When I was in preschool, I had a teacher who went to my mother and said, you know, I want to talk to you about Eric. I'm worried about him. He is constantly playing with only girls. He's only playing with female-identified toys and playing dress-up and all that kind of stuff. And my mom said, he's in preschool. Like, he's fine. Leave him alone. Like, yeah. why are we even having this conversation?
Okay.
So right there.
I'm glad that that was your mother's response, by the way.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Right there, I think my parents set the tone for me to be whoever I wanted to be.
Yeah.
Without me even really knowing it, because obviously they didn't have that conversation with me in preschool.
Sure. That rings really true to me, by the way, because I have four kids. And
yeah.
I have 6-year-old twins, a 9-year-old, and 11-year-old.
Oh, wow.
Think about these sort of gender identifying issues and the sort of the binary constructed world that is trying to be forced upon us constantly.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. It happens before we're even born.
Yeah.
Like with, you know, parents. And I think it's smart, but it's also like so constricted to the binary that parents have to, you know, do gender reveal parties. And then
yes.
Because that dictates how they decorate the child's room.
Yeah.
And what are the choices you get, pink or blue?
Yeah.
And I was in Target the other day and just looking at the toy aisle, it was, you know, three aisles of girl toys and then three aisles of boy toys. Now, wouldn't it be cool if it was like just it was all just intermingled?
Yeah.
And I know that they're for probably organizational reasons, they need to have it differently laid out. But anyway, let's
go. No, that's that. Yeah. I mean, my son has been criticized for wearing nail polish to school.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, that kid's probably 5 years old. So let's not blame the kid. But the parents are.
Right.
Giving improper messages, in my opinion. So anyway, sorry, go on with your story.
No, So then, you know, I was the kid that I had lots of friends that were girls. Since I loved musical theater, I would listen to cast recordings at home. And my parents had figured out that I loved dressing up as a woman in like female clothing and performing these musicals that I would listen to. And they built me a costume closet, and we had a big house in New Jersey, and
nice.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
And so I would like build sets in my room and then just perform these musicals. And my favorite part about it was not really the performing part. It was like the backstage part. So like getting ready, putting on makeup, putting on clothing.
That's
like,
awesome.
It was just fun.
Yeah. And you're six.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so that was my life at home. But then when I would go to school, like I didn't know that I had to conform to this different type of being a male and being masculine and to fit in, like for survival. I didn't know that. So I was the same person that showed up to school as I was at home. And pretty quickly I learned that it was not safe for me to be that person, but I didn't know how to be anyone else. Yeah. So I experienced years of bullying and physical violence simply for being who I was. And at that point, all the way from preschool to high school, I had not come out. Yeah. I didn't know what that... I just knew that I was... I didn't know that I was gay. I just knew that I was exploring like gender and gender norms. And like, I don't even think I knew that. I was just being me.
Well, no kid. I mean, the whole concept of coming out, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this because it means that you are realizing that you don't identify within the culturally created hardened binary norm, which quite honestly, after thinking about it a lot myself, I don't think any of us actually are fully on one side of the hardened gender binary norm, like fully male and embrace everything that is masculinity,
right,
and fully female and everything that's considered femininity. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
The fluidity of those purely conventional labels is human. And so the fact that children have to realize or come out is that's really sad, because it says that, no, first, the presumption is that we're going to reject who you are, try to force you into this construct, and then at some point you're going to have to, after what you went through, and this is very common among folks who do not strictly fit into this binary, you have to come out, and then you're treated. Anyway, sorry to keep on going, but yeah, that is really striking to me.
Coming out is I agree with you that it why do we even have to come out?
Yeah.
But so I see two sides of it. For me, coming out was an acceptance to some degree of myself and a celebration that I figured it out. Like,
yeah.
Okay, this is me.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're right. Like, why do we have to constantly come out to people?
Yeah.
And when I did come out, I didn't know what being gay meant for me, because everything I had been taught up until that point was violence and hate. Yeah. And being told I shouldn't be allowed to be alive. Yeah. For simply being who I was. And so when I did come out, which was at around the end of high school. Now, the end of high school for me was my junior year. Okay. Because my parents took me out of school because my mental health was like at the bottom of the bottom. Wow. And, you know, luckily I was never suicidal, but just depression was just horrible. Yeah. And it was, you know, when you're depressed, it's not just being sad. It's like I couldn't get out of bed. We had a home instructor come to the house to try to teach me. That was the last thing we tried. Before that, I was in a program for troubled youth. And it was a program where I was in like basically a cubicle, a personal cubicle all day. I had no interaction with the other kids in the room. Just the teacher would come and stand over the cubicle and we'd go over what I was working on. And to me, I wasn't troubled. I was troubled because of other people's reactions to me. And at that age, I wasn't strong enough to say, fuck you, this is me.
Yeah.
And if you don't like it,
I mean, who is strong?
Who cares?
Enough? Who is strong enough? Like, how can you expect a kid
right.
to do that? And,
right.
And that the tremendous pressure, you know, this kind of experience. Art, we typically don't do like interviews on this program, but because art is so personal, I think that this story is so important to then how it forms the art that you were then able to express and create, which is why I think this your personal evolution is an integral part of all of this.
Yeah. And then the next part of my coming out story, or my growing up story, was, you know, I left high school in my junior year. I finished school at a community college in New Jersey. And that was a great experience because people didn't care who I was. They just had grown up a little bit. And I was with people who were older than me.
Yeah.
But I carried around a lot of trauma from my earlier years. And because of that, the first part of the gay community that I found was the bar scene. Yeah. So at like 17, I would go into New York City with some friends of mine, and we would go to Splash, a bar in New York City. We'd go to G Lounge, Gym Bar, you know, all the sure. gay bars that a lot of them are not there anymore. And we would party and be promiscuous. And then I found drugs. Then I found alcohol. And then I found lots of, you know, sex that wasn't always healthy for me.
Yeah.
And I got wrapped up in that world from about 17 to about 30. Mm-hmm. And there was, you know, meth addiction, coke, alcoholism, and unhealthy sex practices. Just, you know, not always using protection and just multiple partners that I didn't know.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not stigmatizing that at all. Yeah. It's just at around 30, I decided this is not the person I want to be. Yeah. I want to find a part of our community that is more than this. So when I moved to Houston, about 6 years in, is when I decided to get sober. And I said, I was still doing musical theater, and I reached a point where I couldn't remember lyrics anymore, because I'd done so many musicals that they were all just kind of running together. Yeah. And I remember doing the opening number of Galveston the musical, and we were workshopping and in previews for this show. So things were changing every day. So my lyrics kept changing. And I remember being on stage doing the opening number and completely singing the wrong lyrics. And then, you know, the backup dancers had a lyric cue. So they came out and it was like the wrong time. And I just said, you know what? I can't do this anymore.
Wow.
So I quit.
Okay.
And I said, but I want to still do something artistic. So I took about 2 years to really figure out what that was. And I worked in a hair salon at the front desk. I was the manager there. I worked for an artist, Han Tran, and I was her assistant for about a year. And during that job, I started taking photographs for her of her art and putting it on her website and getting more sales because it was a visual of a visual.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, this is really fun. I would like to know how to do this more. And during this time, I was getting sober. I was, which was a really big journey for me. Yeah. Learning how to be sober in a world that in a world where all I knew was that stuff was very difficult. I went to a few AA meetings, but I decided that path was not right for me. It is right for a lot of people, and I respect it. But I do find that I'm not respected, and people try to take the validity of my sobriety away from me because I don't go to AA. Okay. I simply just don't drink, and I don't do drugs.
Okay.
And I think that comes to like norms. You know, I'm not taking the normal path of recovery, but nothing about being a gay man or being LGBTQIA, we don't always have the luxury to adhere to norms.
Yeah.
We have so many barriers in our way from the beginning that people can say what they want, but this, I'm going to do this my way. That's what I've done my whole life.
Yeah, well, I mean, and becoming the journey to sobriety is very personal.
Yeah.
Again, and that is, I can't see why you would be criticized for not taking the standard path. But now that I say those words out loud, wow, it rings kind of similar to a lot of other things. When people don't take the standard path, however mm-hmm. that is defined conventionally, they are subject to criticism. And wow, the LGBTQIA plus community is always in that often in that non-standard path and the subject of so much negative energy
mm-hmm.
and disrespect, I think, and attacks on dignity.
Yeah. So then I decided, well, I'm going to be a photographer. And I really didn't know what that meant. I just always taken photographs yeah. for years. I had like every little kind of digital camera you could have, point and shoots. And then I said, well, I want to like take this further. So I looked around at what I could do, and I found the Houston Center for Photography.
Wonderful place, by the way. I've taken a few classes there myself.
Yeah, right. It's yes. wonderful. And I had so many amazing teachers who really harnessed the like what I wanted to do. And what I wanted to do was figure out how to really do great portraits. So I was going to do the certificate program that they yeah. have, but then I talked to one of the teachers and he said, no, this is what you need to do. You need to take this class, and this class, and then just go do it. And I said, okay. He said, get the basics
nice.
And then go find your own voice with photography. So great. I said, okay.
The knowledge is what matters, not the piece of paper.
Right.
There you go.
So I did that. And I started Eric Edward Schell Photography. So I had that for about 2 years.
Okay.
And I just quickly built up a client base, word of mouth, social media. I'd never been big on social media, but I just started posting stuff, photographs of really friends. And then people just started hiring me. And I was like, okay. So I kind of faked it till I made it. And nice. Learned a lot. I learned a lot about lighting. I learned a lot about my own take on photography and what I wanted to capture from people, which is really, my goal was to always walk away with images that fully captured that person's spirit and that person's full embodiment of who they were. So I really didn't go about it in a conventional way of like, sit here and let's just take photos. Like, I would talk to people, and as we were talking, I would shoot. We would just like hang out, and I would get these beautiful, amazing shots and real shots of people. And that's what people were really embracing at the time. They didn't want conventional headshots where, you know, it's like a background and, you know, they're just sitting there.
Yeah. Something you get at a department store when we were kids, right?
Right. Yeah. Right. So it was really cool. I really enjoyed it.
And I know that you did a lot of work with LGBTQIA plus organizations before you did Pride Portraits. Isn't that right?
Yeah. I had aligned myself with Equality Texas. I had met Lou Weaver, and he needed a photographer for a project called the Transvisible Project. And that project was humanizing trans people. And it was used right after Hero to continue that conversation. Okay. And then I started working with Human Rights Campaign and some other organizations here locally. And then...
So you're doing activism through art?
Yes.
Early on in your photography career?
Yes. Okay. I started going to every protest I could go to, every rally, and really photographing in a different way than most photographers photograph those things. I would really look for portraits in those situations. And it was interesting for me.
Protests,
and I learned a lot.
Photographing protests can be a real tough thing to do. There's a lot of emotion. There's it's an amazing thing to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, you know, June of 2016 rolled around and the Pulse shooting happened. And, you know, I woke up like everyone else and I saw these notifications on Facebook that there was a shooting in Orlando. And I thought, oh, that's horrible. But then more information started coming in. And it was clear that this was an attack on our community. And I couldn't wrap my brain around the fact that people wanted our community dead simply for existing.
Yeah.
And it also reached two intersections of my identity. They were Pulse Orlando nightclub was hosting a Latin night that night. So there was Latinx people there and LGBTQIA people. So that really hit home to me because those are two parts of my specific identity. You know, so that was scary. And
what a horrible, horrible thing to have happened too.
Yeah. And then the response from it in Houston was really amazing to see. Tragedy, I think, really does bring communities together. We saw this during 9/11, in 1 hour and 42 minutes, both of the towers were gone. And I was living in New Jersey at the time. And I remember we were sent home from school and everyone was just glued to the TV. And after that, New York and people across the world were connected in a way that we hadn't been in a very long time. No. And the sense of community on every level was very strong. And then here in Houston, you know, we kept learning that a 29-year-old killed 49 people and wounded 53 others. And 49 people, mostly LGBTQIA, mostly Hispanic. And that right there brought our LGBTQIA community in Houston together like I've never seen before and I haven't seen again. Wow. I was really good friends with Reza Nori, who owns a hair salon in Montrose. And I remember just spending days at his salon with other people who would come in. And we all would just meet there and talk and like try to heal from this tragedy that wasn't in Houston, but it was felt in such a strong way. And we didn't know what to do with all these feelings because it was scary. Like all of a sudden we realized that this could happen anywhere at any time. You know, we had a false sense of safety, I think, after marriage equality was passed. And I will take full responsibility as a cis gay man. When we got marriage equality, I was like, oh, we're great. Our community is wonderful. Yeah. And I didn't take into account the rest of our community, like the trans community, like the bisexual community. There's so much bi erasure. There's so much transphobia. Lesbians get disregarded all the time. They're not included in things. And but this, there was just the day the Pulse shooting happened, there was a vigil at the zoo that evening. Also that evening was the GLBT Political Caucus's fundraiser, and it was at Meteor, which is no longer here.
It
was that day. Oh. And we all went. And it was wonderful because it was a political is a political organization. The mayor was there. Anise was also there, former mayor. Let's see, Ray Hill was there. Fran Watson was there. I believe she was president at the time. And
the caucus, yeah.
Yeah. And so many people in law enforcement were there in government positions, and they were all talking about how we were going to make Houston safe because Pride was coming up. And it was just such a wonderful experience. And I remember I had not really known Ray Hill that long, but I met him officially that night. And the way he talked about what the tragedy and about what was happening and how we needed to just rise up and fight back was so inspirational. And
what an amazing activist he was.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And our friendship continued until the end for him. We lost him last year, at the end of last year.
Yeah.
Then we had a vigil at South Beach. No, it was a press conference. And so many people were there. Activists across the board. People who simply existing as LGBTQIA, and everyone was hurting. Everyone was scared. And it was, that was, I think, the first time a big, large group of LGBTQIA people were in a space that was a bar or a club.
Yeah.
And it was scary. And, but there was such a sense of unity and connection, and people were hugging each other, and all of, you know, people have fights, people have disagreements, and all of those things just go away.
Yeah.
And they don't matter. And it was beautiful. And then we had the Pulse vigil at City Hall. And it was visually stunning because it was just this sea of rainbow flags and this sea of people. And it really brought out our incredibly diverse community.
Yeah.
And it was the only word I can use is stunning.
And this kind of tragedy, what you're describing now is the amazing humanity that is in all of us, I think.
Yeah.
That is particularly stricken by tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
That we come together as humans.
Yeah.
And we share this existence together.
Mm-hmm.
And let me ask you this, because I have a theory here that we don't want tragedies, obviously, to happen. It's horrible that that happened, and the response is a beautiful response. But one of the things I think that art does is it fosters that humanity without the tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what it, the purpose is. It's mm-hmm. this communication through a medium, whatever it might be, whether it's photography or paint or sculpture or whatever, the written word, it binds us together in these ways that are uniquely individual to the artist, but at the same time commonly human to all of us.
Yes.
So anyway, that's what I think you're doing through Pride Portraits eventually, right?
Yeah. So Pride Portraits started around June 18th because Brad Pritchett decided to make a video talking about not being afraid to go to Pride that year. So he gathered a whole bunch of community activists together and leaders, and we all showed up and did a video, and we all said, "My pride is," and then we put a word in there.
Yeah.
And then we talked about the importance of not being scared and the importance of being visible. Because it was scary. It was days after this mass murder. Yeah. And so that day I started photographing people as they were doing their segments for this video. And we were at Tuam and Bagby, and there was a rainbow paint wall there. And it's no longer there. It was the third one to get painted over here in Houston. But it was beautiful. And I wasn't really thinking, you know, this was a thing. I just started photographing, you know, Dee Dee Waters and Lou Weaver and Fran Watson and other people that were there, Brandon Heavey. And I got home and I started looking at the photos and I said, wow, this is really stunning. Like these, you know, these are my friends and people I look up to. And some I didn't know at the time. And I thought, well, I guess I'll post these online and just let people enjoy them if they want. Because it was weird. We didn't know what to post online because we didn't really want to celebrate anything because it was still so fresh, this murder. Sure. But I thought, well, this is uplifting at least.
Yeah.
So
it's so hard to think about how to respond to these awful atrocities.
Yeah.
It really is difficult because, you know, what's appropriate, what's not, how do you respect everyone's, the way they experience this horrible thing.
Yeah.
But you hit it. Like, this is...
And I didn't even know it. I was doing something therapeutic for myself, but I didn't... I wasn't worried about myself at the time. I was worried about our community.
Mm-hmm.
So I started sharing their faces. So I posted these photos, and I think there was 10 originally. And I went to bed and my Facebook like went crazy overnight and people loved them. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, wow, that's kind of nice. You know, at least people are getting joy out of it.
Yeah.
So I said, well, I can do this again. I mean, it's a wall that's outside. I can go there. I can show up. And so I made a Facebook event and I thought, well, what should I call it? And I thought, oh, Pride Portraits.
Yeah.
So I put that on a Facebook event and told people that I would be there from, I believe it was 3 to 7. And now in the middle of June in Houston,
okay,
it was about 100 degrees right. And super humid.
So a cool day for Houston.
Yeah. And, but I did a long time period because I wanted people to be able to come, you know, in between events or work or whatever. So that first day, about 100 people showed up.
Really?
Yeah. And I don't know how. I don't know why. I think our community was just looking for something positive and fun and uplifting.
You know what? It seems to me there's an obvious reason why that all those people showed up. It's because your individual experience of dealing with this trauma, you did what you could.
Mm-hmm.
And you photographed these people that one day.
Mm-hmm.
That was your way of dealing with it. And then you shared that artistic individual way of dealing with trauma, and so many other people shared in your experience.
Yeah.
That and this is that thing about art, which I love, which is that it's uniquely individual to you Eric Edwards shell.
Mm-hmm.
But then you shared that with the rest of us, and wow, we're all humans together.
Yeah.
And people shared in that part of who you are because we're all in part of that.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, and as I was photographing people that first day, and I did a second event, and even more people showed up. And so I did three events at this wall. And during that time, people started talking to me while I was photographing them and sharing all kinds of stories about their lives. And, you know, it was really beautiful because they were healing, I was healing. It was wonderful. And I remember one of the people I met during one of those shoots was January Leo, and she's an ally to the community. And until then, I don't think I thought about the importance of allies in the way that I do now, because she has kids and she worked at Legacy at the time. And she just started sharing with me all the reasons why she was an ally and why she cared so much. And we have now developed a wonderful friendship to this day. And so I went home and I started thinking about January. And I said, God, she has such a wonderful story. I wish I could share that somehow. So I thought, well, my next photo shoot, I'm going to have people write statements. I said, what do I want to ask people? And I decided that I wanted to ask people, what do you want the world to know about you? And what I've found over the last 3 years is that that's a very unique thing. People don't get stopped and asked who they are. Especially within our community, I think it's very rare that people actually want to know who we are as humans.
Yeah.
Yes, we all have these wonderful identities within the LGBTQIA spectrum, but we're so much more than that. We are doctors, lawyers, homeless.
People,
you know. People. Yeah, just people. Yeah. And so we did a launch of Pride Portraits. I had met at the time an artist who came to one of the open shoots, and his name was Hugo Perez. Okay. And he's a fantastic artist. And I had never seen his work, but we met for lunch and he said, I'd like to get involved somehow. And I said, well, I need a backdrop that's portable because I can't keep doing this outside.
Yeah.
And
new studio.
Yeah. And I hadn't seen any of his work, but I commissioned him to do a backdrop. I said, I want something prideful. I don't want a literal pride flag because I want allies and other people within our community that don't necessarily resonate with a rainbow flag to feel comfortable doing the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And he took about a week, and I went to his studio and he unveiled what's now the Pride Portraits backdrop to me. And I remember standing there for about 5 minutes in complete silence, just staring at it.
Wow.
It was like he took what was in my brain and put it on a canvas. And I still remember how I felt looking at that the first time. I was in awe. So we decided that we would launch this campaign officially as Pride Portraits. We had like a roundtable discussion and decided that Pride Portraits would stand for photographs representing individuals deserving equality. So we did this launch event and it was wonderful. So many people showed up to support what Pride Portraits was. Still at this point, we hadn't decided fully what it was.
Yeah.
But we started taking statements and doing the photographs.
Is this still in 16?
This is, yes. Okay. Yeah.
So still early on.
It's still very early on.
It snowballed pretty quickly. It got big fast.
Yes.
All right.
And then I had reached out to Aiden Dowling, who's a very prominent figure in the trans community. And he has a YouTube channel. I reached out to him and said, hey, I would love for you to be involved with this thing I'm doing. It's called Pride Portraits. I explained it's about humanizing LGBTQIA people. And he wrote me back and said, of course, but I'm in Eugene, Oregon. And I said, yeah, I know. What if we came there? How would that work? And he said, well, if you can get here, we can do my photo, but I'll do you one better. I will host a event for you at a queer space here, and we'll get everything donated, the space, the refreshments, the food, whatever. And we'll do that. Okay. And I said, perfect. So Hugo and I gathered what little money we had and got on a plane and went to Eugene, Oregon. We spent the weekend there, and it was such a magical experience.
Wow.
And we came back to town, and I met up with Fran Watson, and she said, hey, Eric, I think you need to be a 501c3. And I said, what's that? And
always good to know a lawyer like Fran.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
And so she explained to me what it was and why it would be important. And she said, I think you have something here that's bigger than you think. And I said, well, I don't know. I'm just having fun. Like, I you know, I like celebrating our community. I like telling our stories. I don't really want to turn it into something legal.
Yeah.
And, yeah. You know, I thought about it for a while and I said, you know what? I need money. Not me personally. The campaign needs money.
Yeah.
Because I want to be able to travel around the country and reach people in more marginalized communities that don't have a platform to be visible.
And that's precisely why the 501c3 structure exists, to facilitate this kind of work.
Yes. Because there are organizations like Human Rights Campaign and GLAAD and Facebook and Chevron that can pay my travel.
Yeah.
But then there are so many organizations that don't have any money that really need this.
Yeah.
So if I have enough funds to say, hey, I can get on a plane and get there, all you have to do is find me supporter housing, fine.
That's
so we formed the 501c3. I am very transparent about the fact that I have never collected a salary in 3 years. All the money that we have raised has gone directly back into funding the visibility of the campaign and going to separate locations.
So you support yourself through your independent photography business, not,
yes,
not through private portraits at all.
No, no.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's a big sacrifice.
It is, but it's one that I really enjoy.
And here we are today. Pride Portraits is nationwide. It's a big thing. You've had all kinds of celebrities, political leaders, so many people on. It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. It has definitely become something I never thought it would become. Sitting one-on-one with Nancy Pelosi, yeah, Karamo Brown, Melissa Etheridge were things that I never even dreamed were possible.
Yeah.
But they believe in the campaign. They believe in the work, and they believe in the importance of visibility.
And it's so important that those public figures embrace what you're doing, because that normalizes that which has been marginalized.
Yes.
And that isn't that what we're part of what we're doing here?
Yeah. Yeah. And so it has been amazing. Organizations like Facebook have reached out to me, and I've worked with them twice now. And we have a continued working relationship, and I have followers in 48 different countries, a lot of which being LGBTQIA is not culturally acceptable.
Sure.
So for them to have this space where they can see and read stories of people like them and give them solace is such a wonderful thing that I feel very proud to have been able to create.
Yeah, absolutely.
But even though I have all of these wonderful opportunities to reach visibility beyond links I ever thought, the heart of Pride Portraits, you know, we're headquartered here in Houston for a reason. It's because we started here. Houston is one of the most diverse cities in the country. And we have so many amazing local heroes. Even people not doing big things are often overlooked.
Yeah.
And there's just so much to be celebrated right here at home.
Yeah.
You know, people like Fran Watson, who ran for Senate.
State Senate, State 17.
Yes. Yep. I mean, what an incredible campaign. She was a woman of color, a lesbian, and we just don't see that. We don't have that kind of representation here in Texas, yeah. And we need it.
She rolled she ran a boldly progressive campaign, yes. That was true to her and her identity and her community, and yeah. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
We had her on the show and she was great.
Yes.
Yeah.
So one of my best friends in the world is Stephen Miranda, and he has his hand in so many different areas in Houston. He's political. He's a theater director. He loves LGBT history. And he's someone who really, really uplifts Houston in a very positive way.
Yeah.
He is right now doing he's in the process of writing a book about the person he was named after, who died of AIDS and was forgotten by his family.
Oh, wow.
And all that history was wiped away. So he's damned and determined to find out why.
And these folks who you photographed, the local heroes who you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
You know, full disclosure, what we're doing here on H-Town Progressive is kind of copying you, honestly, right? Because we're focusing local.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, we consider you to be one of our local heroes. And so thank you for what you do every day. It really is wonderful. And that is, I think it's such an important thing that we have so many good people here in this town fighting for these kinds of progressive values on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to hear from them. We need to see them. So see them in your pride portraits. And we want people to hear from them as well in these kinds of conversations and discussions, so that those who might feel marginalized, those who might not want to speak out, or might feel like they're not part of the conventional society, can say, you know what? Oh, no, there are more of us out there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. And they have all kinds of identities.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're an inspiration. So thank you.
Thank you. I think that... Thank you very much. I see inspiration in people like J.D. Doyle, who runs all of, he has a couple websites. One is HoustonLGBTHistory.org.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to know anything about history, go to one of his sites.
Okay.
He also created the Obituary Project, which he has gone back years and years and years and collected obituaries of people who died of AIDS.
Wow.
Speaking of that, two of my favorite pride portraits I ever did, and the most impactful to me, were Dylan Carrera and Larry Jones.
Okay.
Dylan was 18. Larry was in his 70s. I went to the Omega House here in Houston, which is an AIDS hospice house, and I met both of them. And talk about heroes. These are people who their facet of the community is often shunned, stigmatized, and overlooked. And we did their portraits. They shared their stories with me. Dylan was 18.
Yeah.
He was diagnosed with HIV. Didn't know that he needed to go to the doctor and get his symptoms looked at. So that he was diagnosed pretty late. And at the point when I met him, his HIV had progressed into AIDS, and he was on medication and he was doing better. And I don't think he had proper education about how to continue to stay healthy, because within a month he was gone.
Oh, wow.
But I heard these stories from an 18-year-old and a 70-year-old. And that work is so important to me, to tell the stories of people that would otherwise not be able to be heard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for that work. That's tremendous. And I haven't seen those portraits. I'm going to go back and look at them.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll link to your social media from our side as well.
But, yeah.
Eric Edward Schell, thank you so much for sharing your story with us, the story of Pride Portraits, and the story of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, we really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right.
It's been a pleasure.
Next week, we'll continue our focus on LGBTQIA+ issues as we talk to Lou Weaver about respect, dignity, and access for Houston's transgender and non-binary community. Hope you'll join us. So if this discussion made you think, motivated you, or hell, even made you angry, hit that subscribe button at htownprogressive.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to tell all your friends about us. Also, check out our website at htownprogressive.com, where, among other cool things, you'll find transcripts and photos for all new podcast episodes shortly after publication, with back episodes coming slowly but surely, and also on request. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. If you have a comment, a topic idea, or a guest suggestion, email me at rob@htownprogressive.com or give us a call and leave us a message with your comments at 281-915-9561. Again, that's 281-915-9561, and we'll put your message on the show. Thanks for listening. I'm Rob Itchsazan, and this is H-Town Progressive.